Hi there, and welcome to another entertaining and interesting episode of Horse Sense, a show for the thinking horse person. At Horse Sense, we give you practical, relevant, up-to-date, and even inspirational information to enrich your horsing life. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. And if you're returning, a big thank you and welcome back. This show is brought to you by the Equine Care Clinic, a clinic dedicated to the care of sick or injured horses when their owners are unable to. Check out the website at www.equinecareclinic.com for heaps of information and resources, or the Facebook page. I'm your host, Amanda Edwards, and this week we're talking to Pauline Naughty of the Equine Cushings and Insulin Resistance Group. There's a mouthful. A vet nurse and equine acupressure practitioner, Pauline is a first responder for the group in Australia, and she gives some great hints and tips for managing horses and ponies with Cushings and insulin resistance. And I get heaps and heaps of questions about this, so for those listeners, enjoy. Hey Pauline, so hi, how are you going today?
Oh, very well, thank you.
Welcome to Horse Sense, it's really great to have you.
It's a pleasure.
So tell the listeners a little bit about you and what you do, how you got there, and how you got to be a first responder for the Equine
Cushings
and Insulin Resistance Group. I'm always like ECIR.
I'll give you the short version.
Yeah.
My background's in veterinary nursing, so I had been doing that for 25 years and decided I needed a break. Horses have always been my passion. I had my first horse at the age of 16, so that was quite a while ago. But probably in the last few years, I had come across my horses who were diagnosed with Cushing's and insulin resistance, and subsequently, after a lot of misdiagnosis and misinformation, I had came across the ECIR group, and we didn't look back from there, as far as their information being first class, spot on, up to date, and backed with science and fact.
Which is, it's always really hard, like managing a horse with Cushing's, and usually we find out when they've got laminitis or some other thing, so you're trying to battle through all of that and get them well again. It's really quite hard, isn't it? So, and now you're a first responder, so tell me what that's about.
The first responder pretty much just greets people who have joined the list for the first time. They're obviously upset, they're frustrated, they're anxious, they're worried about their horse, you know, everything that I had been beforehand. Mm. So we just introduce them to the philosophy, which is DDTE, which we will go through bit by bit. And my job being in Australia is I tend to Australianise the American concepts of it, because it is based in America. Even though there are over 12,000 members and it is worldwide, a lot of it is, you know, American feeds and things like that. So I just tend to Australianise it a little bit and make it easier for people.
Yep. Translator.
Yes. To speak, yes.
So tell us a bit about what's the difference between Cushing's and insulin resistance?
The symptoms of Cushing's and insulin resistance can overlap.
Yeah.
So it is sometimes a bit difficult to get a correct diagnosis. So Cushing's is when there is a benign tumour or growth in the pituitary gland. So therefore, you'll often hear it called PPID, which is pituitary pars intermedia dysfunction.
Everyone get that?
So there is a dysfunction of some sort in the pituitary gland, which causes the hormones, which is mainly the ACTH. Which is the adrenocorticotrophic hormone, to become imbalanced, and therefore...
And that hormone kind of, that controls a lot around the insulin uptake into the cells, and how the horse kind of, it has a whole lot of impacts on regulating the endocrine system, doesn't it?
It definitely does. I mean, it is known as the master gland or the control gland.
Yeah.
So it does control a lot of other hormones as well, but mainly the ACTH is the level that you want to try and stop from rising, so to speak.
And that's the one that they'll measure when we do the diagnostics,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah. It also influences the cortisol, which is the stress hormone. So you'll often hear that used in conjunction with PPID and IR.
And is that,
horses.
Like in humans, you know, I hear that the stress hormone cortisol, when you're, you know, stressed and so forth, that actually makes you hold weight. So is that the same in horses? Because Cushing horses are often, at the start, they can be quite thin, but they often have an obesity problem early on, don't they? Yeah.
And more so, perhaps more related to the insulin resistance side.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, definitely has can monitor with weight and things like that. So yeah, that's something that we
maybe I should take. it'd be
a bit of a worry. So the symptoms of Cushing's, you'll see lethargy.
Yeah.
You'll see muscle loss. So mainly the top line. So you'll get that atrophy and loss of top line.
Yeah.
You'll get the pot belly appearance, like a hay belly.
Yeah,
as
or
well.
Even the old grass sort of wormy looking horse.
Yeah, pretty much.
Thrift.
Sort of ill-thrift.
Ill-thrift, that's the word I was looking for. Thank you, Paula.
You'll also get laminitis, but you'll get more of a laminitis issue in autumn rather than your typical spring grass-induced laminitis. And that's to do with the natural elevation of the hormone ACTH, which occurs in all horses. But
that was a really interesting fact. I didn't know that until I was talking to you earlier, and I was like, ah, that makes sense, you know, because the vets always tell you, you know, up the pergolide in autumn, but no one tells you why.
Why? It's what's known as the seasonal rise.
Yeah.
And it's a phenomenon that is not, they know it's there, but it hasn't been well and truly studied. But, you know, again, with the database of 12,000 members that do regularly blood test their horses, a trend, you could definitely see a trend occurring, pre-fall or pre-autumn.
So going back to the insulin resistance, how would you differentiate between the two? I guess in the ACTH won't be up in...
You can have a horse that is just PPID. You can have a horse that is just insulin resistance, or they can be both.
Right.
So the way to different, because the symptoms do tend to overlap a little, sometimes it's the blood work that'll differentiate between what's going on. Mm. Visually, once you've seen a few, you can tend to pick it. So with PPID at a later stage, you'll tend to see that shaggy coat, the shaggy curly
coat.
Shaggy
curly coat,
The hirsute horse. So, but that tends to be when they're at a later stage. So you can have a horse that looks, hasn't got a curly coat, he doesn't have Cushing's. Okay, he's in early stages, if that's the case then. So you don't always use that as your telltale symptom of that being an issue.
But it is a good sign if you see it.
If you see it, yeah.
But it won't necessarily be the exclusion if they don't have it.
No. My Appaloosa never had a curly coat. He was a short-coated horse all the way through. So, and I was surprised when his bloods came back as a positive.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting too, isn't it?
So insulin resistance can be best described as a loss of insulin sensitivity. At a cellular level. So, and insulin's the hormone that regulates how the body uses and stores glucose and fat.
Yeah.
So you'll tend to see, that's where you see your fat horse, your cresty neck, your fat lumps on the tail rump. And
cellulitis type looking little Welshies.
Now, that's... You won't always see that, though.
Yeah.
That's usually a giveaway. And not all horses that have... at a cresty, you don't automatically assume they've got insulin resistance.
Mm.
They can just be fat.
Yes.
So it's...
We're seeing a bit more of that too. Like, I'm seeing a lot of little obese horses around that, the different feeds that we feed these days,
yes,
I think have led to a bit like a... takeaway fast food for humans, we're getting the same kind of obesity crisis in horses.
Absolutely, with all the sweet feeds around. So with an insulin resistant horse, you'll see the abnormal fat pads. You'll also see in the geldings, you might see a fatty sheath.
Okay.
And excess smegma production, so you'll get that. You can smell it a mile away.
So smegma. Smegma is great terminology, and what is that?
It's an exudate that builds up in the sheath,
around
in the guttural pouch,
and
things like that. It's a bit like thrush in the horse's foot.
Yeah,
you can smell it, and you'll see that waxy. Sometimes you'll see that waxy discharge stuck to their legs.
Yeah.
And look, most horses do have it, and that's why they have sheath cleaning. But we're talking excessive production.
Yeah, more than you would expect
that to be normal. And you may see, bladder, mammary enlargement in mares.
Right, yep.
So, and they're obviously not in foal or anything like that. So that's another bit of a giveaway sign. Again, history of laminitis, but this time more commonly induced by grass.
Yeah.
So you're having that sensitivity to the sugars
in
the grass. Puffiness above the above the eyes.
Yep.
Is also another sign as well. And then advanced symptoms, drinking and urinating more. So excessive thirst.
So almost looking like a diabetic person.
Yes.
So a lot of the same sort of symptoms, only in horses.
Yes.
So even though it's not the same thing,
but
it is affecting the glucose
uptake
into the cells, and that's what diabetes is all about too.
Yeah.
So it's along those same lines. So if people can kind of think about it in that way, it helps them, I think, manage the feeding side of it.
Yeah. So with human diabetics, you'll find that the glucose is usually elevated.
Mm.
With horses, the glucose is usually normal and their insulin is elevated.
What I liked about the ECIG philosophy is the framework that underpinned it. So the DDTE, which is diet, diagnosis, diet, trim, and exercise. So let's unpack that a little bit.
Sure.
So, and we'll start with diet.
Okay. We usually start with diagnosis first.
Well, that's probably a good idea.
Yeah, because you need to know what you're dealing with first. So it's just amazing how simple. These four letters can make such a difference that if you follow them.
I really liked that because I can remember that.
Yes.
You know, DDTE. Yeah. Okay, this is what I've got to do.
It's getting all your ducks in a row.
Yes,
pretty
exactly.
Much. Okay.
Yeah.
So first thing you need is you need to know what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
So diagnosis is by blood work.
Yeah.
Okay. It can be done by a single blood draw.
Yes.
Which can do all the testing for the ACTH.
Yeah.
We also test for insulin, glucose, and leptin.
Yeah.
As well. So leptin's just another marker of an insulin hormone. It's only been out in Australia probably 3 years now. So some vets still may not be aware of it being around, but it is something that the group recommends.
That's a really good. So I think go in forearmed if you think your horse has got Cushing's. If you don't have an equine vet, you might need to ask them if they're going to do leptin and could they. So, because they can easily add those tests, but it's a bummer to try and do it later.
Yeah. There is only one lab in Australia at the moment that is doing leptin, and that's Gribbles.
Yeah.
So, most veterinary practices do deal with Gribbles pathology.
Oh, yeah.
So, it shouldn't be such an issue. I guess one of the contentious issues is the method of testing for the ACTH. We recommend a test that's called endogenous ACTH, whereas some vets still like to do a test called the DEX suppression test.
But that's really not recommended these days, is it?
Not recommended because there is the very slight chance that you could induce laminitis by injecting a cortisone injection. And if you've got a horse that's on the edge,
it
can tip them over, and we've seen it before, so we don't recommend that.
So what Pauline's talking about is the DEX suppression test is that the vet will give them a dose of dexamethasone and then do the testing and
give them some DEX, and then another blood draw a couple of hours later, so it can
to measure the rate. But as she's saying, that's not really the latest research practice. So if your vet's suggesting that, probably don't go there.
Yeah. I mean, it's a much easier method. And if you've got a horse that's needle shy, yeah, it's really easy just to get all
one
the blood in
blood.
One. Yeah, do it once and then do that. So obviously then the blood gets sent off to the labs and then you get your results back. So then, and you know what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
Are you dealing with a Cushing's horse? Has it got elevated insulin? Has it got both? And then why, you know, sometimes uncontrolled Cushing's can elevate the insulin.
And the other thing to mention there too is that sometimes that pain will elevate ACTH. So it's important to get your pain under, if they've got laminitis and you're testing for Cushing's, get the pain under control first.
True. But if you've got the horse on bute, I mean, obviously under veterinary guidance longer than 3 to 5 days, and I think I was going to discuss that later, that if you're having a thyroid panel done, and some vets do like to run a thyroid panel too as part of a hormone profile, is that bute can affect the results of a thyroid panel. So you just sort of need to be aware of that
If your vet's sort of saying, you know, I don't want to take it just yet, those might be the reasons why he or she is thinking along those lines.
Yeah. And that you'd probably get that. I mean, if it was an acute case of laminitis, you'd sort of maybe back off in doing that a little bit and get the horse under control first. But otherwise, there's not a...
When I get them in at the care clinic, they're usually that crippled that we do have to wait. So I'm seeing them at the worst end of the stick.
Exactly.
Other people, you know, people that are managing them at home are not seeing them that far down the track. So.
And that's a really valid point. The other point we should make is that the horses aren't fasted prior to a blood test. So we like them to have either hay access 24/7, or if they happen to still be out in a paddock, you know, just keep it as normal. But don't give them any grainy foods or anything like that at all prior to the blood testing too.
Good. Great.
So once you've got your diagnosis, we then start dealing with the management plan of working out the diet is where you need to look at probably first. Just backtracking a little bit, if your horse has been diagnosed with PPID, it needs to be put on medication.
Yeah.
So PPID is controlled by medication and diet.
Yeah.
Whereas insulin resistance is controlled by diet and exercise.
Yep.
So the guideline for the diet is you want a combined sugar and starch intake of approximately 10%.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So that's a guideline.
10% or less?
10% or less is fine.
Hard
to make sure they're still getting a good nutrition. And they can get a great nutrition. So that's for... That's the composition of each and every individual meal.
Yeah, okay.
That you want as your total. So that means, you know, testing your hay, for example. So, you know, I test my hay regularly when I get a new batch.
Mm-hmm.
We send the hay tests to America mainly because it's much, much cheaper than...
Yeah, it's quite expensive here. And we don't really test for the...
The sugars and starch. Well, we don't use WCS terminology, but... if you use the labs in Australia, they tend to outsource the sugar and starch analysis to America anyway.
Yeah.
So you end up spending more money than you need to do. The cost of sending a hay test to America is roughly around $80. So it's really, depending on the currency at the time.
Saves you a whole lot of stress and bother, doesn't it?
It does. The downside to it is just the turnaround time might be a little bit longer, maybe 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
But it's really worth the wait because you also get your trace minerals results with that too.
So, so where do you source low sugar, for want of a better word, hay?
And
what is low sugar hay?
Okay. It's not
or
easy.
Low GI.
Low GI. it's low carb hay. It's, it's the buzzword at the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
From experience, I found that native pastures tend to be traditionally low in sugar and starch, or lower than that 10% threshold that we like.
Mm.
So I always try and source that if I can. We tend to avoid anything that's got lucerne in it, clover, oats, that sort. Anything that looks, you know, rich and that you'd feed a racehorse, we try to do the opposite. But that doesn't mean you need to feed poor quality, stemmy, mature, you know, last year's batch hay.
Yeah, because a lot of people will say to me, has anyone got any last year's hay? Because I've got a Cushing's horse. So they're trying to get that. But that's not, you're saying that that's not the...
You don't want bad quality. You want good quality hay, and it's attainable.
Yeah.
But you just don't want a rich, good quality hay. So, in some ways, to avoid that, you can soak the hay.
Yeah, okay.
So you would soak it for 1 hour in cold water or half an hour in hot water, and then get rid of the water on your plants or something. Don't let the horses drink the nice sugary water that is in there.
So that brings us to the other point of the colour of the water. A lot of people will say to me, oh, I soaked my hay and it's so much sugar, I could see it was almost tea-like.
Yes. Yeah.
And that actually is not the case, is it?
No, that is a misnomer.
Yeah.
That's more than likely to be soil contaminant, dirt. And you really cannot tell what the hay is unless it's tested. But it's not feasible always for people to test hay. If they've got, you know, they only get 2 or 3 bales a week and it's from a different source all the time, or, there's
that's
a drought and the quality is a little bit, you have to change all the time. So it's a matter of common sense, really. If you can source some hay and, you know, get a year's supply or even 6 months supply, by all means test it. And then you know what you're dealing with. If not, soak it. And you might find that once you get your test results back, you might have to soak it
a bit
anyway.
Yeah.
No, just because you might have a hay that comes in at maybe a combined sugar starch of 11%, which is just over that threshold.
Yeah.
So if you soak it, you can reduce the sugars up to 30%.
Yeah.
Starch doesn't soak out, and starch converts to glucose.
And we've talked about, like I talked before, where we've talked earlier about, you know, some of the research is conflicting around to soak or not to soak. That seems to be, was a very hot topic there for a while. And some of the research came out and said, well, there was quite a bit of variability on how much they reduced the water soluble carbohydrate level, depending on the time.
Yeah.
So, and I think alfalfa hays, which are lucerne hays, mm-hmm. didn't soak, they didn't leach, but pasture hays did, but some only reduced by, you know, a few percent and others quite a lot more. But what do you say to that?
Well, we find from, you know, we've got over 12,000 members on the ECIR group, and a majority of them do test their hay and some do need to soak their hay. So, and some people actually will go to the extra length of soaking their hay and then having it tested to see how much that reduction is. And the aggregate figure that we're getting back is 30%. And that's over a wide variety of hays.
Over time, too.
The easiest way is to do it for an hour, because you don't want to be leaching back iron back into the hay, which can sometimes happen.
And in Australia, listeners, the iron, we have a high iron content in our soil, which tends to mean that the iron is within the hay, and if you soak it for a long time, it starts to get reabsorbed back into it.
The other thing about metabolic horses is that they tend to be iron overloaded anyway.
And the aluminium sometimes, often too. The iron and the aluminium tend to be higher, so that can be a problem as well.
So we tend to try, that's why we try and like to keep, we don't like supplements or anything like that that have got added iron, and just about everything's got added iron in it, so it's just a matter of being. That's why we like to,
and also just on that point, in the feeds will have iron in them because they've come off the land, but also what I didn't know is that the caking agents have aluminium. So I ended up with a iron and aluminium toxic, so worming pastes. And what a caking agent is an agent that keeps things from glugging up.
Mm.
So it's like in your copra or whatever that people use, it will stop it from clogging up. So that's a really high aluminium, and that will actually cause the iron to rise as well.
They can compete. The minerals can compete.
Well, they have a sort of like an action that makes the other rise as well. So that was interesting for me to find in another sort of testing regime. So, yeah.
So that's where we like to, when we get our hay results back, we then make a specifically formulated mineral balance that will literally balance that hay. So, you might find that you've got to add extra copper and extra zinc, but you do it in a ratio so that they complement each other rather than compete with each other and, can reduce uptake. It starts getting quite involved. And
that's why you need some help along the way. And that's where someone like you comes in.
And there's a lot of information.
There is
a group, like an outreach group, which you'll have a link to.
Yep, that'll be on the show notes.
That is open to anyone to read, and it is just chockers full of
up-to-date information. Really, really good, which is why I end up contacting you, because I was like, this is great information. I get so many questions about this topic. So
as far as grainy feeds go, no grains whatsoever. So there's a couple of safe feeds around for Cushing's horses, or metabolic horses, sort of categorise them together. One of them is Speedy Beat.
Yep.
Or Beaty Bites, or I think we have Speedy Beat here.
I think, and High Gain has now got Micro Beat.
Yeah. Ones with no molasses. And that's quite safe to use. Most horses like it. Sometimes you have to be a little bit patient when you're introducing it to them. But for palatability and things like that, it's fine. And it's a good low carb.
Adds the protein and adds sort of a bit of calorie to it.
And fibre. Fibre too. But with Speedy Beat, you normally need to rinse it first.
Yep.
Then soak it, and then rinse it again until you get the brownness out of the water.
Yep.
Out of the content, and then that's fine. So because it has got a bit of added iron into it, so you're just reducing that. That iron. And the other product, which I have no part in the company at all, but I love Maxi Soy.
Yep.
It just, for ease of use, the horses love it. Sheep eats it, and you can hide the minerals in there.
I think you need to just watch the aluminium level, because the aluminium can get high in Maxi Soy because of the caking agent. They need more because of the way it is, but it is a good feed. So
yeah, in all honesty, we haven't come across that as being an issue with testing and things like that. But
I might be seeing that. See, again, I end up with the...
You get the critical cases.
I get the critical cases, and so I'm probably seeing the really... And we try and really balance them very finely.
And that's where you find your mineral balancing really can help with those sort of things as well. Probably the other thing being is starvation diets don't work.
I think this is really...
In my case, with my pony when he was first diagnosed, and I didn't know anything about it, I was pretty much told to put him in a dirt paddock and give him one biscuit of hay a day and keep him ramped up on butte for a few weeks. So and that was a bit scary at the time.
And particularly for those little ponies, I know a number of people who've ended up with their horses getting hyperlipidemia,
which
is essentially breaking down of the fat cells, causing a massive toxic overload to the liver and the systems, and the horse dies.
Yes.
So it's really, I actually wonder how more horses didn't die. I have done this treatment of lock the poor horse up with one biscuit of hay, and I look back and think, how did I not kill more horses?
Yeah.
It was
common practice, but education... And studies and things like that have progressed, and our train of thought have progressed. So it's a natural way to think now. So we like the horses to have hay 24/7.
Yes.
They're not designed to be starved. Not designed to go any longer than
4 hours. A
whole lot
of problems if they don't have access to hay or forage over at least a 16 out of 24-hour period of the day.
So that's where those the slow feeder hay nets come in.
Yep.
And if you've got
love my slow feeders. I've got everything in slow feeders.
Yes, they are brilliant.
I'm and even if you are giving grains and things, slow that down as well. Mm. Bocce balls. I use bocce balls in the things. Some people say stones, but they've got to be big stones.
Yeah.
But it actually, even that will slow down the gutsy horse, and very good if you've got a horse that's prone to choking.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Now, the contentious issue with the diet, before we move on to the next part, is pasture or pasture access. So the philosophy of the ECIR group is no pasture.
Mm.
Full stop.
Yeah.
No grass. That's it. Dry lot. Make a track. Get them off. Just get them off the grass. The sugar and starch content at the time when you're trying to get the horse stabilised from a potential laminitic insult, if that's what it's had, is it's just too variable. You can't control it, so therefore you take the horse off it. Very, very much later, maybe down the track, you could put a horse on limited grazing.
And when you're talking about the limited grazing too, the other thing that I've learnt of late is that on limited grazing on grass that is 5 centimetres or more high, because it is that short,
the stressed grass
yep. right down at the roots, so the 1 to 5 centimetres is the piece that's going to, and because most of us have small lots,
mm-hmm.
this is why it's so variable, yes. and you can't control it. But if you do have the ability to do strips and you can keep the grazing up higher, you can do it.
Yeah.
But again, it's that tricky balancing act, and certainly when you're trying to stabilise them.
No grass.
They just have to be, you have to be able to control all the elements to get it right,
yeah.
don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll probably find, with a Cushing's horse, with a Justo horse with PPID, it may be able to tolerate some grass down the track, because ideally you've got it on pergolide mesylate, yeah. which is the medication for PPID. You've got it on a balanced diet. Your ACT level is down. Everything's cosy. It may be able to tolerate some limited pasture grazing on non-stressed grass. An insulin resistant horse tends not to cope very well with any grazing at all. If you've got a horse, for example, it's an Arab, it's an endurance horse, and it's getting all that exercise and work, it's going to be able to tolerate a little bit of grass at a certain time at some stage.
Yeah. I think, too, we've got to take into consideration the way we keep horses now, which is quite different. On small acreage, we can't get them, we can't replicate what's happening in the wild, so we have to manage it when they've got these conditions. Now, the other thing we haven't sort of talked about is that two things that I want to go back to is Cushing's always in an illness of the older horse.
No. Our horses are living a lot older now, so therefore we are seeing it now. It tends to be mid-teens and starting into the late teens. We have had them as young as 8 on the list. That's not a common thing, but you always keep that in the back of your mind. When someone comes onto the list lets us know what the symptoms are, what they're dealing with, what the vet's done, blood tests, the vet's always involved. We like the vet to always be involved with these cases. Mm. And there are some breeds that are more prone to it, perhaps, than others. But you'll also find that with insulin resistance can affect any age.
Yeah. So that's that question. The other question I have is, let's go back to pergolide,
mm-hmm.
because that's a whole topic on its own as well.
Yes.
So pergolide is the medication
for PPID.
For PPID.
Pergolide mesylate.
And we need to stress too that it's not going to cure your horse. This is a horse that, if you think about the diabetic human, they don't get cured, they manage it.
Exactly.
And we are only ever going to manage the PPID because that benign tumour sits there. It will get bigger over time, but usually the horse dies of old age before the tumour actually... So it impacts on the hormone imbalance, but it's not going to kill them. So pergolide is the medication. So tell us a bit about what's the right strength? Because there's a lot of the strength. You know, this is the other thing is like I've got them on 3 meals. I've got them on this. But what people don't realise is that often in Australia we're getting liquid pergolide.
Yes.
And storage of that is critical. And it's also a much lower dose in that liquid than you would get in the capsules. Can you talk a little bit about
I'd forgotten how contentious this issue was.
Yes.
Okay. And we do differ in some respects, but in the States. So the correct dose is the dose that controls the ACTH.
Yep.
So I had my little Shetland pony was on 13 milligrams a day. My 15-2 Appaloosa was on 7 milligrams a day. Now I was using capsules, and we had to keep on increasing. Liquid pergolide does not hold its efficacy.
Yes.
For as long as perhaps the manufacturers would like you to think, and there are tests in the States that have proven that.
And it also has a lower milligram
It's one milligram per 5 mil.
Per 5 mil.
Yeah. You always start your dose off at
the lowest one.
At 1 milligram.
Yeah.
You always need to the dose rates up because there is a phenomenon known as the pergolide veil.
Yes.
Which if you hit, and you'll get that with other medications too. If you hit them with a full dose too quickly, they may become a little bit depressed, a little bit lethargic, go off their food. They're already feeling pretty crappy. So it just sort of just adds
You're
to
messing
that,
with their hormones. Yeah. We all, as ladies, we all know what that's like.
Don't mess with the hormones, yes. so you always titrate up to your dose. And you tend to, your starting dose with the liquids tend to be like 1 mil.
Yeah.
With that. And you work up to 5 mil, which is your 1 milligram.
Yes.
Dose.
But that's a small, small dose when you consider I guess what I'm coming at is that
some horses can be controlled on 1 milligram.
They
really
can. I did have a horse. The horse that I was looking after that we got her stabilised on 3 mils, which would be, so not quite a, you know, so. But I think the capsule, one, I'd have to say, make sure you know what your milligrams are instead of just the mils.
Yes. So what your milligrams per kilogram per dose rate is. There is, I tend to like compounded pergolide mesylate because you can then have your vet write a script for the dose that is required.
Yeah.
So if you needed, for example, 1.25 milligrams of pergolide, you could then have that specifically made for that particular dose.
And you can actually send for that online, and it's a whole lot cheaper too.
Yes, it does work out cheaper, but you know, again, your vet does need to be involved.
Yeah, most vets are very happy
with that sort of thing.
Most vets just don't know
that
they can actually get it.
Some vets can be a little bit funny about compounding, but the labs...
Compounding just means making it up and putting it in a capsule.
Yeah.
And then when you get
it... To a required dose or flavour that you need.
So, and then I tend to like to mix that up into a syringe and just syringe it into their mouth. Yeah. So I know they've got the dose that I'm giving them.
There is now available, it's probably been maybe 2 years out in Australia, but it's been in England and America for a while, a commercial form of pergolide mesylate available in 1 milligram tablets that come in a foil. That's another option as well. Getting back to it, if you are using the liquid, make sure you keep it in the fridge door.
Yeah.
That's probably the best way. Definitely don't keep it out in the heat.
And out of light.
Yes. They usually come in a brown bottle, but they still, you know, it's better to be. And even though the liquid form is not what we consider to be the best form, I still consider it to be better than doing nothing at all.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not that it's not effective.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
I ran that horse on liquid the whole time.
Yeah.
Until the end when I discovered the...
Just if you have to increase, it maybe doesn't become as cost-effective.
No, and that's what I was searching for. The owner wanted some, wanted to try and reduce that cost. So.
Yeah. So one thing I'm going to touch on very, very briefly, because this is a whole nother 5 hours of discussion if we went into it,
I know.
Is fructans. Okay, so fructans get a lot of press regarding causing laminitis and things like that.
And what's a fructan?
Okay. Well, I can tell you what it's not. Fructan is not, it's not a sugar. So, and it can't be digested in that, and doesn't produce a sugar rise or anything.
And how do they get a fructan? Where would they get a fructan from?
Oh, okay. That, so this is where the 5 hours.
Yeah.
five-hour conversation comes in. Fructan can be in some grasses, but they would have to eat...
A lot of it.
I don't know, truckloads in the shortest amount of time to potentially cause an issue.
If people start talking about fructans, don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
Is that what they're saying?
Yeah, pretty much. And again, on the ECIR... list on the outreach group, and also the Facebook page too has a lot of information about that, and it's backed by science.
Beautiful.
So, you know, it sort of doesn't get much clearer than that. It'll still be a contentious issue.
Well, yeah, because people like to believe things even if it has no evidence, and that's okay. That's called faith.
Yes, true. Okay, the other briefly thing we've got to touch on is treats.
Yes.
So
I was going to say to you, now what about apples and carrots?
Yeah, gone.
Yeah,
gone with the grass.
Gosh.
So apples.
Turn them into a rabbit, give them celery. You give your celery,
I give
don't
mine
you?
Celery.
And I actually really like it. I gave the little laminated pony I've got now. She's on celery and she's quite liking it.
It's an acquired taste for some of them. I was going through 10, 20 kilos of carrots a week. Yeah, no wonder I was having issues. And it's not, I mean, I like to give my animals treats.
Yeah, we all like to give them carrots.
It's a human, part of human nature to do that. I like giving myself treats. Yeah, that's not, you know, I should pay attention to that.
We should eat more celery.
So celery is safe. They look green, it's crunchy, it's watery, safe to you. Iceberg lettuce, obviously not the whole lettuce, you know, a lettuce leaf is fine. A dried prune, you know, one of those prunes are fine. That's good to hide medication in. Sugarless and mint.
That's a good tip.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, even a grape, one grape. I used to hide my capsules in one grape, and that was like, oh, heaven, until the grapes got sour. So anyway, so that pretty much... touches the very surface of the diet component, I think.
Yes.
It does can get
quite involved. Get quite complicated, but I think
it shouldn't have to be complicated, though.
I think that gives listeners a start point on the most common things.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's probably the area I get asked most about. Yeah. And there's a lot of conflicting stuff out there. So I think it's really been great to have that piece of it. So, on to trimming.
Okay.
So, the feet.
So, trimming is not my area of expertise, as far as I'm not a trimmer, I'm not a farrier, so I'm not going to get into too much detail about that. But getting the trim on these horses' feet is just so integral to the whole plan. It's sometimes the missing link. You've got your diet in place, you've got your medication in place, the exercise, well, we'll worry about that shortly, but you're still seeing maybe a footsore horse or it's a bit ulchy or a bit sensitive, and that comes down, most of the time comes down to the trim.
Because the lamina are quite sensitive to the... You know, whatever causes lamina to be sensitive, and we're not quite sure of that yet. Bit of debate around that too.
Yeah.
But keeping the wall, like I'll just talk, I've got this little pony I'm looking after at the moment, and she's a little mini, and I got there and she'd been put in with the big, well, she's actually one of those little Houdinis.
Mm-hmm.
So she had put herself in with the big horses who had a massive great hay roll. And so by day two... She was very, very sore and laminitic, even though she's not fat.
No.
And when I looked at her feet, her hoof walls were quite long. So by taking that hoof wall right back to the ground level, you're taking away, it's a bit, I describe it as like walking on your toenails if you dropped a brick on them.
Yeah.
And then tried to do
very
it.
Good.
Yeah, yes. And that's how painful it is for them. So if you keep those trimmed back, they're not putting the pressure on.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a bit like if you got your toenails too long and you put it inside your runner. It's that kind of
thing. That pressure. So
if you think like that and you trim that back, that's what I see the trimming component to be. It's just taking the pressure off.
And sometimes the trim does need to be done in stages.
Yes.
If you just can't, if you've got a horse with those, you know, the pixie slippers, you can't take it back to, you know, an immaculately, correctly pathology trim straight away. You need to, I mean, obviously you get rid of the pixie feet, but it needs to be done in stages. Yeah. The horse's body needs time to adjust.
Exactly, to it, and because it's, that can be, and that's what I've done with this little one, her back feet. She's been pushing, I think she's been laminitic for a long time, so clinically, and she's been pushing back on her back feet, and her back feet have actually become quite elongated.
Yes.
And she's now putting pressure on her tastons.
Yeah.
So the trimming on that part of it is really important, because I've seen another horse who had done that for so long that the back pastons were almost a 45 degree, like they were really sloped, 30 degree slope. It was, and essentially that horse became lame from his stretched pastons.
Yes.
His tendons.
Tendons,
so. Anyway.
So laminitis, just to differentiate, it's a painful inflammatory condition of the connective, of the tissue, of the laminae that bonds the hoof wall to the pedal bone or the coffin bone of the horse's hoof. So you can imagine it a little bit like Velcro. And found it is just
lots of blood supply.
Yeah, it's a very vascular.
Very vascular.
Well, you want it to be a vascular area. If you haven't got that circulation happening, that's when you start having problems too with the laminitis. And found it is just when the coffin bone is actually, I wouldn't say peeled away, but it's actually dropped away from the inside of the hoof wall, and it's pressing down on the solcorium. And sometimes that's when you'll see penetration come through as well, which is, it is, it's not a death sentence, but it is a lot of hard work and dedication.
It's to lots of hard work. I've had a couple of those. That's when I get them.
Yes. Yeah.
Lucky me.
But both, both are still extremely painful conditions that you need to be
managed. And if you can't get the pain under control, they often don't survive.
Yeah. You need to get that pain under control. And, you know, as a, beauty's used, I guess, is the number one easy to use painkiller, and there's nothing wrong with bute as long as it's used with common sense and by the guidelines. And the guidelines is no longer than 3 to 5 days.
And you can flip across to Devil's Claw after which is quite an effective herbal analgesic, anti-inflammatory.
Oh, what? Yeah, white willow. I like Devil's Claw. White willow bark is also okay. Perhaps not as
And you can do a bit of a combination of those. Well, Devil's Claw and white willow can be really helpful. And that can mean that you can get them off the bute because it's great. Like, bute's a lifesaver.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
But it also has side effects that can, you know, cause problems with the gut. And the next thing you're dealing with a colicky gastric ulcer horse. And
if you've got it, if you have them on too long and then you just stop them, you have this rebound effect as well. So there are alternatives out there. We use a lovely herb. It's called Jiagalan.
It's got a great name.
Yeah. It's a lovely Chinese.
It sounds like it's, you know, it sounds like kind of French.
Yeah. It's probably not pronounced that way. We call it J-herb.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's got fantastic for vascular problems.
Yeah.
It's just wonderful, but it can't be used in acute laminitic situation. Yeah. So you need to get them over that crisis, and then you look at alternatives for that.
And that's important to make sure that your vet knows if you're using, and I just talked to Sue Martin and interviewed her, and she's, you know, equine herb. Mm-hmm. She makes equine herbs, and she's, you know, very strong on this point that you don't mix medicines and herbs, and you make sure, because everything is, it's got a
everything
component.
Is a reaction.
Yeah. Yes. So you, and some things can, you know, if you put bute and Devil's Claw together, that's not a good thing.
No.
That's what she was saying.
Yeah, so. And absolutely agree with that. They will be contraindicated in that way. I mean, even herb, you know, herbs sound all lovely and I love using it, but they're still a drug. They still affect a change in the body to some degree, so therefore, you know, they come under a drug classification.
Yeah.
With that, with the trim, we also recommend you get x-rays done.
Yes.
Because your trimmer needs to see, and your vet and you need to know you know, perhaps what degree rotation is happening. What
and
is the
where
sole,
is
the sole thickness?
That's a big one.
How much toe can you take off? Because you, even though you might be able to see it visually, that just gives you, it lines it up better with where the pedal bone is.
Yeah.
We like to have a short heel.
Yep.
We like a low heel, short toe.
Yep.
And then we usually have the bars that are passive.
Yep.
With that, and that's, but the correct trim is the one that hugs that, I would say hugs the coffin bone in the correct position.
Mm.
With that. And that sometimes takes a little while.
It can take a while
it
to
takes,
get right.
Yeah, this didn't happen overnight. So this, you know,
that's an important thing too. Like, this is medical management,
mm.
and it's not like surgery where you can just go click and it's done.
Yes.
It's quite a bit of trial and error for the individual horse. The same as if you had a chronic medical condition in a human, it will take trial and error. Like if you've got high blood pressure or if you've got diabetes, there's a bit of fiddling around to see what's going to be the right mix for you. So
yeah.
Just remember and be patient and you will get there.
Yeah, it does. And the other thing too is using boots and pads to support the horse. If that's what makes the horse more comfortable, then by all means use that to make them more comfortable too. You can use, sometimes we put baby nappies in the boots just to give them that little bit more cushioning and stop the boot moving around if it's not quite the perfect fit. You can use styrofoam and duct tape. Duct tape's great for that sort of thing if you've got no boots.
Mm.
I mean, there are ways of going around.
Andrew Bowe's Barefoot Blacksmith mm-hmm. website, they've got very nice rehab pads and treatment boots so that the horses feel really good in. Like, you put those boots on and you can almost see them go.
It's like having really good underlay on your carpet.
Yes.
It's just that sinking
or
feeling.
Really great gel pads in your runners.
Absolutely. Because I was booting and padding one particular fella, he was being booted 24/7. I had no problem with that. I made sure it was kept clean, you know, the pads were changed. But because I was having such a high rate of padding, I was using the camping mats from Clark Rubber and just cutting them into, made a template, cut into size.
They don't last very long. So the
rehab
pads...
I was changing one or two times a day with that.
Yeah, so the rehab pads tend to last quite well.
Yeah.
So they'll last
may not have been around.
They probably weren't. I have used those as well.
Yeah.
So, but certainly, if you haven't got access to the rehab pads, just go to Clark Rubber and get the highest density you can get, and awesome with some nice soft memory foam over the top, and they love it.
Yeah, they'll appreciate it.
Yeah,
And also, I mean, with the trimming and the founder and laminitis, and one thing to keep in mind is that it's a whole body issue. It affects the whole body.
Mm.
So you need to address not just the feet, but you also need to address the body issues as well. So, you know, get a body worker in and have the horse at massage. Get an acupressurist in, or someone who does acupuncture. You know, just remember to address all, you know, those situations as well. So exercise, that's the last part of the DDTE. Exercise is only to be done if your horse is pain-free and sound enough to do it. If your horse is sore, don't force it. Yeah.
No, and allow them to lie down and rest.
Absolutely. Lying
down
is
fine. And get them in
fine.
Nice, soft sand or, you know, even at the moment, the ground's so dusty. The little horse I've got, she's out there in the dust pile. That's where she stands and lies. So she's having lots of rests at the moment.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yes.
You know, in the old days, we used to say, get up and, you know, move them around.
Yeah.
It's not a circulation issue. It's a blood issue.
Yeah.
So
So if they're sore, definitely. If they want to lie down, let them lie down.
Mm.
That's not a problem with that. Addressing the insulin resistance side of things, exercise is the best IR buster there is.
Yep.
It helps with all that glucose intake. It utilises the metabolism. It makes you, you can then work the horse. You can, and that has a long-lasting effect, as in you could go out and exercise your horse and it will work, last for 24 hours or so, or even a couple of days, it just depending on the amount of work you do. If you are working your metabolic horse, you obviously need to adjust the diet a little bit to counteract those calories, but that goes back to diet and that becomes a bit more involved. So when your diet is being balanced, that can be addressed with that. But apart from that, when you are starting the rehab, just hand walking.
Yeah, take your horse for a walk down the road.
Around the block.
You know, you used to walk your dog. Now you can walk your horse as well.
Yes. Yeah, and I used to do that with my little pony.
Yeah, and particularly for the ponies, because a lot of us have got the, some of us have still got the kids' pony, and then we end up with all these issues. But I am like you. I used to take the dog and the two dogs and the pony down the road. All looks very odd, but people get used to it.
Yes. You become popular.
Yeah, and everyone wants to come and see and pat the pony, so that's all good. Get to know the neighbours.
Yes. And, I mean, even things like long lining. Preferably no circle work. Mm. So no, doing tight, lunging in tight circles or anything like that. You don't want them swivelling on their feet while they're still in a healing phase.
If your horse is insulin resistant as opposed to PPID, having what I will do then is on the track, like if you've got an area where you've made a track for them to be, then you can put the slow feeders down the track and hang them so it relieves boredom and gets them moving.
And you're imitating the walking and grazing situation
Paddock Paradise is, there's a website around that and there's a book around that, which is quite interesting read for anybody that's interested.
Yeah, so that's a definite positive with that sort of thing. And even with your PPID horses, if you've got them off the pasture, which they can survive. There is actually on the, I'll leave the link with you, one of the vets on the ECIR group wrote a brilliant article story about a horse not being on pasture. And it really sends, it's a really hard concept for people to understand or to get their head around. So
people feel that they're being mean.
Yes, they're not.
But they're not, because so long as the horse can graze, it doesn't have to be on the ground.
No.
So you can replicate grazing with lots of slow feeder hay nets, and they can graze as much as they like on those. Yeah. So it's around getting our mindset over what we think is mean.
Yes. That's exactly right too. So you've got everything in place and you're ready to start riding your horse. You usually like to wait one or two hoof growth cycles. So that can be 6 to 12 months before they're ready. And ideally you have x-rays done before you're ready to take this on, just to make sure that you have you've got a correct balance trim and that the reversed the rotation, and then everything's fine. You're sound, you're good to go. So you just need to start doing just very gentle. I mean, it's just like building up a horse that you've brought in from a pasture that's been turned out for a while.
So you just don't overdo it.
Yeah,
work to the level of tiredness and stop.
That's both horse and owner.
Yes.
That sort of pretty much covers the exercise. I think the main point is not to push the horse when it's not ready to be walked, and no tight circles.
Okay, well, I think we've covered the framework, and really what I like to ask people is at the end of the interview, what's the thing you'd really like to leave people with? The key, a key
phrase
or message takeaway.
So I have two. Because I can't differentiate between either of them.
You can have two.
And they're both from Dr. Kellen, who is a co-owner of the ECIR group. Yeah. So, and one is halfway measures get halfway results.
I do love that. Yeah.
The other one is hope is never gone until you choose to abandon it.
Yep.
And that they're pretty much
powerful.
Sums it
I just
up.
Got little goosebumps there. I do love that one. It's just so powerful. It's amazing what you can do if you kind of are open to trying a range of options. So, I just want to say thank you for your time today, Pauline.
My pleasure.
I know that this interview is going to go gangbusters because I get asked so much about this. So thanks so much and have a great day.
I will. Thank you very much.
Well, I know I learned a lot of really great information from Pauline. three key take-home messages I got from the interview were, number one, horses and ponies with the Cushing's and insulin resistance can actually live happy, comfortable and productive lives. Number two, management includes the right feeding and medication regime, trimming and exercise, and the all-important proper diagnosis. Number three, there's always hope. I hope you got as much out of this as I did. You can find links to the ECIRG in the show notes at horsesenseshow.com. And if you like this episode, please leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher or Audioboom. If you've got questions, leave them there too. As we go along, I'll be reading these out on air. Tune in next week for another cool episode of Horse Sense. Until next time, may your horsing be great horsing, and goodbye.